This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me tonight is Mike Morrison. In this episode, part two of our two-part discussion on the problem of identity in Star Trek, we'll examine the problem of personal identity, some examples of where identity comes up in the Star Trek universe, and some possible solutions to the problem of personal identity. Well, Mike, how are you this evening?
I'm doing well. I don't feel quite like myself. I feel a little divided.
Well, I've got to say, I'm actually going to Vegas, Las Vegas, tomorrow night for a little vacation. I'm taking a week off from work and going to Las Vegas. Sadly, it's not during Star Trek Las Vegas. I was a little sad I couldn't make Star Trek Las Vegas this year, but I plan to be there for 2016. But I'm going to scope out my position for 2016.
There you go. Go ahead and book your room at the Rio. Exactly. If you can still book a room at the Rio.
Well, we try to go over a couple times a year, so I've never stayed at the Rio, but I am looking forward to Star Trek Las Vegas 2016. I'm hoping other people from the network can descend on Star Trek Las Vegas next year. This is a little plug for going to Star Trek Las Vegas if you haven't been there before. It'll be my first time. I hope other people who haven't been there before who are listeners or people from the network will be there. We can have one grand Trek FM party there.
I am saving my pennies.
So I'll scope it out, guys. Don't worry.
Excellent. Excellent.
Well, Mike, let's dive into our topic. So this time we're going to talk about personal identity in Star Trek. And last time we talked about the problem of identity in Star Trek in general. And the problem of identity is the problem of what accounts for the persistence of an object over time. You know, as anything goes through time in any object or any person, that object or person undergoes changes. And you can always ask the question, well, if that object has changed over time, what is the reason for thinking that that object is literally the same object over time? You know, when I accumulate new experiences as a person or when a character in Star Trek has changed, and I'm thinking of radical changes. I'm thinking of things like the Picard that you see in season one of Star Trek: The Next Generation, or versus the Picard that you see at the end of Star Trek: The Next Generation, or even something a little more drastic like TV Picard versus movie Picard. Right? There's personality differences, new experiences that have been accumulated, physical features have changed. So as a person undergoes change, what accounts for that person being the same person over time? You know, we have this deep-seated intuition that our identity remains the same regardless of what new experiences and new or what changes we undergo. So what accounts for that? And is that intuition correct? Is there any sort of philosophical, metaphysical basis you can give for thinking that that people remain the same over time? And last week, we examined the Ship of Theseus example, which is a well-known example from the history of philosophy. And the problem is basically this. There's this ship, and it's an account given of the biography of Theseus by Plutarch. But Theseus and the young people of Athens are on their way back from a trip, and from Crete, I think it was, and the ship is falling apart around them, right? Oars are breaking down, the planks are rotting, the mast is broken, and so piece by piece, they start replacing out the pieces of the ship to the point where, by the end of the story, every piece has been replaced. And so you can ask this question, given all these changes, what is the reason for thinking this is the same, literally the same ship as it used to be? And I think what's fun about that example and about all such similar philosophical examples is the fact that our intuitions get pulled in two different directions, right? On the one hand, it's the same ship because it has the same structure and the same form and all the factors we talked about last week. But on the other hand, all the materials have been replaced such that you could literally take those materials apart and build another ship if you wanted to, and then you'd have this problem of there being two ships. So we talked a lot about several different answers to that philosophical problem last week. We talked about the Enterprise as the starship of Theseus, but now we want to talk about personal identity. And what's fun about that example or that topic, the shift into personal identity, is the fact that people just have different properties than inanimate objects, and the fact that we have properties like memory and consciousness give us many different possible answers to the problem of identity from the perspective of personal identity than you can talk about with inanimate objects. So you can really kind of have a deeper discussion. But it's what's fun is that you have all the problems of the problem of identity in general, everything we talked about last week with the Enterprise of Theseus or the Starship of Theseus, but you have all of these problems with personal identity based on these new features of people. So it's really kind of a more complex discussion and new things we can talk about. So Mike, I know I gave kind of a long-winded introduction to the problem of personal identity. Do you have any opening thoughts on personal identity in Star Trek or some pre-philosophical, pre-Star Trek intuitions about identity over time, personal identity over time?
Yeah, I'd actually like to really apply those principles of the Ship of Theseus to my life. I'd like to be the Mike of Theseus, replace some of those hair follicles that have fallen out and shed a few of those pounds that I've put on. I've been married to my wife for 21 years, so you know I have to ask the question, am I really the same man that she married 21 years ago?
I think, you know, this is a podcast on Star Trek and philosophy, but what's fun for me about thinking about philosophy is the way in which this is personally relevant, right? We're going to talk about the personal identity of characters in Star Trek here in a minute, but for me, I think everyone has this kind of intuition, right? There's a sense in which there's this deep-seated core of myself, personality traits or values that I hold, you know, several things we could talk about that really seem to persist over time. There's not a lot of change mm-hmm. to those core elements, and yet there's all these things that do seem to change, right? New experiences, new perspectives, new friendships, whatnot, right? And there's a lot that changes. And then you have to kind of weigh this list, you know, what has changed and what hasn't changed in your life and what accounts for this sense of identity over the time. And, you know, I actually, this is kind of a personal story, but I recently came across an old journal of mine, an old diary, and I was opening it up and I was reading through the words and it's something I hadn't looked at in, you know, probably 20 years. And a lot of it sounded familiar. I could see the same tone of voice, some of the same optimism that I get about the universe. I can kind of, you know, feel myself in reading those words. But it was kind of a naive, more youthful, more ignorant version of myself writing those words. And it's fun because, you know, it was clearly me, and yet I'm not the same person I was back then, right? I'm an older, hopefully wiser, definitely I have a little less hair, right? But hopefully I'm a little wiser than I was back then. But I don't. There's another sense in which I just don't feel like the same person as I used to be. But there's this dual intuition, and I think like a great many philosophical problems can be accounted for by the fact that our intuitions get pulled in two directions, and I think that's particularly salient here in the problem of personal identity, right? On the one hand, we feel like we're the same person that we used to be. When we see a character in Star Trek, we sort of go, yeah, that's Kirk. And even if you look at, like, you know, the young version of Kirk on the original Enterprise versus movie Kirk, you know, you can see this kernel of Captain Kirk that is the same throughout all those experiences and changes, throughout the weight gain. You know, Captain Kirk puts on a few pounds, but there's a twinkle in the eye that is Captain Kirk that remains the same. And I think all of us can relate to that. There's a kernel of ourselves, and yet there's a lot that's different. So I think it's easy to kind of dismiss the question as being kind of, you know, philosophically abstract and not terribly practical, but this is personal identity. This is who we are. So I think of all philosophical questions, this should be one of the questions that has the most personal application and relevance as people reflect on their own lives.
Yeah, I think you and I were talking in the Turbo Lift last week as we were recording the first part of this discussion, talking about the differences from ourselves as young men. I know for me, looking at some of my core beliefs and reevaluating those over the years and rethinking things, as most of our listeners have already surmised, you know, my background is theology. Even taking a look at my own core theological beliefs and reevaluating those over the years, and asking the question, how has that changed me fundamentally? Things that are a little more on the surface, you know, becoming a husband 21 years ago, becoming a father 13 years ago. How do these things in life change us as people? And or are we even essentially changed, or are we just the same people with you know, different experiences. And as I said, you know, in the first part of the discussion, this is really a rich topic of exploration. And again, I don't think we're going to be able to cram the complexities of this topic into, you know, one, two conversations. I'm sure we'll be revisiting this topic many times in future podcasts. But when we look at this topic, for me, personal identity is really the most interesting of these two conversations in many ways. And it's a very complicated philosophical discovery. We can tend to sometimes oversimplify it, I think, Zachary, but there are so many interesting questions that really need to be raised when we examine personal identity. And Star Trek explores these questions quite a bit, and I'm looking forward to the discussion today.
Well, let's go ahead and dive in. In addition to the, you know, there's this ordinary sense of personal identity, right? You know, a character in Star Trek will change over time, like movie Picard versus TV Picard or movie Kirk versus TV Kirk. You know, are there other places you can think of where the problem of personal identity comes up in the Star Trek universe? Anything on your list?
Oh, yeah. You know, as we look at this, we have to look at change, persistence, sameness, and time. You know, in abstract, you can ask the question, you know, how is Captain Kirk different, for instance, after leading the 5-year mission and spending those 5 years out in space and then spending time as a Badmiral? How did that change him? We've talked about Captain Kirk as a Badmiral. How did that essentially and fundamentally change him? On the topic of Captain Sisko, is the Sisko of season 7 the same as the Sisko that we first met in the pilot episode Emissary? And how was he fundamentally changed? I mean, when we first meet Benjamin Sisko, he's a commander. He's a father trying to raise a young son. He doesn't want to be assigned to Deep Space Nine. In fact, I think probably one of the most interesting scenes I've ever seen in a Star Trek episode is that initial conversation that he had with Captain Picard. You know, there, and I have to really tip my hat to those two actors. They played that tension so well. And, you know, there was definitely tension there, and that tension was personal for Sisko as a character. If we're looking at this in universe, it was a very personal tension. He caught Captain Picard off guard, which, you know, I've got to really hand it to him to be able to catch Jean-Luc Picard off guard. He certainly wasn't embracing the notion of being the emissary to the prophets. As a matter of fact, in that initial introduction to Jean-Luc, he had no idea that he was the emissary to the prophet, had no idea that, you know, his mother was part prophet. So essentially, how did we see him change? Did he change, or did he fundamentally stay the same? Those are fantastic questions.
Well, let's use some of those examples to frame the discussion a little more philosophically, right? So last time when we were talking about the ship of Theseus, we talked about the problem of numerical identity. And the problem is basically this, right? If two objects are identical with each other, in other words, if they're literally the same thing, right, they should have all of their properties in common. And I think it's unquestionable that characters like Captain Picard and Captain Sisko undergo changes in the course of their tenure on our TV shows that we love on Deep Space Nine and on the Next Generation, right? The characters change, right? That's kind of a given, and it's obvious. But given that, you know, take Sisko at the beginning of Deep Space Nine and Sisko at the end of Deep Space Nine. They have literally different properties, right? And it's even something as simple as the goatee that Sisko grows in over the course of the later seasons of Deep Space Nine, right? If you write down all of the properties that Sisko at the beginning of Deep Space Nine has and the properties that Sisko at the end of Deep Space Nine has, it's a different list, right? Whether it's physical attributes like the goatee or whether it's mental attributes like experiences and whatnot. But if you really sort of toe the line with this problem of numerical identity that we mentioned last time, the idea that any two things that are identical with themselves should have all the same properties, well, it sure looks like on the surface that they don't have all the same properties. So metaphysically, the challenge is, in what sense can we provide a sense of sameness of identity over time, given the fact that they don't on the surface look like they're numerically identical. They have different properties over time.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm not sure if Leibniz's law would really apply here. If we can pull away from metaphysics for a second and look at the physical change, if we look at the physiology of the brain over time and the changes that it undergoes chemically, you know, the neurological changes within the brain, you know, one can argue that no, these, you know, essentially season one Sisko and season seven Sisko are not the same. So does that really apply here?
I think so. I mean, I think that's the fundamental problem, right? I mean, one answer is that they're literally not the same person, right? But that's not a very satisfying answer, because there do seem to be attributes that persist over time, right? There are character attributes of Captain Sisko as a character that do seem the same. You know, whether they're, despite whatever new experiences or whatever physical changes he undergoes, there are some core values or some core personality traits that account for that character, that account for our intuition that the character is the same character over time, even despite those changes. But, you know, that itself could be an illusion. I think the metaphysical challenge of identity of numerical identity, Leibniz's law, you know, can't be sort of dismissed out of hand, because I think that is the philosophical problem behind personal identity. You know, if we don't sort of force the issue about Leibniz's law and the identity of indiscernibles, that two things that are identical should be literally indiscernible from each other, have the same properties, in other words, then there really is no problem with personal identity. So I think of the Leibniz's law challenge as the intuition that generates the problem of personal identity in the first place. So given that, you know, if it is the case that Sisko season one and Sisko season seven are not numerically identical, whether it's brain states, physical attributes, experiences they have, we need to find some other way of accounting for our intuition that it's the same person over time.
Yeah, and let's really kind of shake things up here a little bit. You know, we can look at someone like Benjamin Sisko, but let's look at Jean-Luc Picard, his abduction by the Borg, having the Borg implants, you know, physiologically changed. Let's even one up it from that. Annika Hansen.
Yeah, and what's fun about these changes over time is there's kind of on a sliding scale, right? You have the ordinary sense of accumulating new memories, right? Day-to-day changes, right? Every day that goes by, I accumulate new memories. Every episode of Star Trek that goes by, the characters accumulate some new memories and experiences. But you can imagine a progressively radical spectrum of change, right? The experiences of Captain Picard getting turned into Locutus, getting assimilated by the Borg, that's a pretty radical change, right? It's a radical physical change. There's radically different experiences. He's part of the collective consciousness. And so that is a more radical type of change than the ordinary sense of accumulating memories over the passage of time. Annika Hansen, I think that's an even more radical change, right? You know, Annika, the little girl, is ripped out of her entire environment, put in a totally new environment. Her consciousness has changed because she's now part of the collective. And that doesn't just happen for a week, right? This happens for years, her entire lifetime, until she is liberated from the collective. So that's, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, this really radical sense of change. And so, you know, again, it sort of forces the issue even worse, right? You know, if you stick to the first end of the spectrum that we talked about, this ordinary sense of change, there are some responses philosophically that I think you can give to the problem of identity. One that comes to mind is John Locke's view that the sameness of a person over time is a result of the continuity of their consciousness, right? The gradualness of the change. And we talked about this a little bit last week when we were talking about the ship of Theseus, or the starship of Theseus, that, you know, when you're replacing parts of a starship, that doesn't happen very drastically, right? These are little changes over time, except in the cases of a major refit. We talked about the case of the Enterprise being refit from the original series to Star Trek the Motion Picture. That's more of a radical change, but if we're just sticking to day-to-day maintenance, right? The replacing of a self-sealing stem bolt, you know, one day at a time. That's a pretty gradual change. And that's what it's like to accumulate new memories, right? As a character in Star Trek goes from episode to episode to episode, most of the changes that they undergo are fairly gradual. And so John Locke's view of personal identity is that this continuity of consciousness, yeah, there's change, but it's gradual, steady change. And so that gradualness and that continuity, the flow of a person's consciousness over time in that steady way is the feature of their consciousness that accounts for the sense that they're the same person over time. But, you know, what does that mean for these more radical cases? You know, Picard being assimilated by the Borg, or in the worst case scenario, Annika Hansen now being liberated from the collective of Seven of Nine. Does the continuity of consciousness apply in those more radical cases of change?
Yeah, I think if Seven of Nine were here, she would probably say that Leibniz's law is irrelevant. A and B are not indiscernible. They are different. But I think when we're talking about, you know, continuity consciousness, so here the idea is that it all depends on consciousness rather than substance. You know, that we are the same person essentially to the extent that we're conscious of past and future thoughts and actions, just as we're conscious of present thoughts and actions. So consciousness, if I understand this correctly, is thought and not just the substance. So that really kind of makes me think of Janet Lester from Turnabout Intruder in the original series, you know, in an entirely different way.
Can you explain what you mean there, Mike? I'm not sure, quite sure what you're getting at.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Turnabout Intruder is we have Kirk and Janet Lester actually switching consciousness. Mm-hmm. Janet took over Kirk's body. Kirk is trapped in Janet Lester's body. This kind of churns up the, you know, to what extent if thought is really just consciousness, if consciousness is thought and not just substance, you know, how do we look at Janet Lester in the body of James Kirk?
You know, you're getting at something that I really love about Star Trek, and this is why we can talk about Star Trek and philosophy, and it's richer to talk about philosophy in Star Trek than it is to talk about philosophy in other franchises, right? Star Trek plays with these ideas. You know, we have crazy examples and pieces of storytelling that you get in Star Trek that you just don't get in other franchises, right? We can talk about transporter accidents generating, you know, Thomas Riker versus William Riker, and we can ask questions of personal identity about that. Heck, even just ordinary transporting, right? Beaming down to a planet, your whole body gets taken apart, your brain gets taken apart and reassembled down at the other end of the transporter beam, and you know, we in universe the end result, the characters that emerge on the planet are the same person, right? It's not even questioned. But you know, the example you mentioned of a consciousness being switched from one body to another, that's not something that's part of ordinary experience. So what's fun for me about the problem of personal identity is it comes up in two ways. It comes up in the ordinary sense of accumulating, you know, new memories and personality traits over time, but it also comes up in these really radical thought experiments. And what's fun about those thought experiments is they really force you to think, well, what features of our consciousness really do account for our personal identity? And you can play with these permutations. What if a consciousness was implanted in someone else's body? What if your entire brain was taken apart? But before we dive into that, I want to spend a little time talking a little more about the continuity of consciousness. Think about what your day is like. You know, you go through a day and you accumulate some new experiences, and at the end of the day, you're tired and you lay down and you go to sleep. In universe, this would be something like, you know, Captain Picard goes through his day as captain of the Enterprise, and in the evening, he gets back to his quarters and he goes to the replicator and replicates a hot milk toddy, you know, a recipe from his Aunt Adele, and lays down and goes to sleep. Right. And then while he's asleep, he's presumably not conscious, right? There's an interruption in his consciousness while he's asleep, and then he wakes up and goes, you know, throughout the business of the next day. But even in ordinary day-to-day life, without positing these crazy Star Trek type examples, there's a disruption in the continuity of our consciousness. So you can ask this question: is the Picard that goes to sleep the same person as the Picard that wakes up the next morning, given that there's a disruption in his consciousness? So, you know, one plausible answer to the problem of personal identity is this continuity of consciousness. But when you really ask how continuous is our consciousness, you know, if you get hit over the head or you go to sleep, if Captain Picard takes a hot milk toddy before he goes to bed, is he the same person that wakes up? It sure seems like even in daily experience, our consciousness isn't very continuous.
Yeah, we got to watch where we tread here, because in the Star Trek universe, anything is possible. Quite frankly, Picard could literally go to bed one person and wake up another.
But I think that is the problem of personal identity, right? You know, that could, that's an answer, but is that a problem? Does this interrupt our deep?
Sure, seems like a problem to me.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a problem, right? I mean, it sure could be that at the end of the day, that there's no good answer to the problem of personal identity, and that the answer is, yeah, every minute that goes through your day, or season one Picard and season seven Picard are literally different characters, literally different people in some deep metaphysical sense. words. And that might be the answer. Is, I guess my question is that world disrupting? Does that interrupt our sense of who we think we are as people? Would that throw your entire sense of not personal identity in the metaphysical sense, but does that throw your sense of self into chaos if you weren't the same person that you were last week? Is that problematic for you, or is that something you can dismiss as not terribly interesting, not terribly relevant to who you are? So in Star Trek, Mike, it seems like not only do we have to talk about ordinary change over time, you know, a change that Captain Picard or Captain Sisko undergoes over time, but we have to talk about transporters, transporter accidents. We have to talk about alternate universes and mirror universes. And, you know, like there's a Captain Kirk and two mirror universes, and you see the mirror universe again in Deep Space Nine. But, you know, are you the same? Are you identical in some sense to your partner counterpart in the mirror universe? Are you identical to yourself in an alternate universe? So Star Trek really does play with these ideas in a very non-ordinary sense. And I think this is either really satisfying for people who like thinking about thought experiments and like thinking about how those thought experiments are brought to life in a science fiction context like Star Trek. But for people who really want to stay grounded in the ordinary sense, right, the question of whether you're identical to yourself in an alternate universe is not going to sound like a terribly practical problem, right? So you do have this problem with philosophy in general, that some of the examples are terribly abstract, and they're more like thought experiments, and there's not always a really practical import. But that's why I do want to keep going back to this ordinary sense of personal identity, you know, yourself over time, or in universe Captain Picard or Captain Sisko over time, you know, as your consciousness dips in and out of being, as you you know, are awake in some moments and are asleep in other moments, as you accumulate new memories. So there's this deep-seated sense of personal identity being grounded in the ordinary. But personal identity also comes up in these crazy science fiction examples that Star Trek plays with. And, you know, for me as a philosopher, those are really fun and satisfying, but I could imagine that people who are not interested in those kinds of thought experiments might find the question of personal identity terribly abstract or not terribly practical or interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, I think about the episode Tapestry, you know, to what degree are we the sum of choices that we make, the tufts and loops, if you will, of life? And, you know, pulling one thread, do we unravel the person that we are? We've kind of talked about that in our discussion on determinism and free will. I think about the bundle theory. I know it was one of the things that we were kind of talking about in the Turbo Lift when we were putting this episode together. Do you want to talk a little bit about Hume and the mind-body issue with the bundle theory?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Scottish philosopher David Hume had an answer to the problem of personal identity. And his answer was basically that there is no sense of self other than the fact that we're a bundle of our perceptions. You know, if you look at what it's like to be consciousness, you know, right now I'm doing a podcast and I've got visuals in front of me. I can see you, and I can see our editor Dennis on the screen in front of me, and I can see things out my window and things on my desk. I'm hearing you know, the vocals from you. I'm hearing some things in the other room. You know, there's an overwhelming wave of perceptions that are coming in each moment you're conscious, right? But for David Hume, he literally thinks our sense of identity, it just is the collection of these different experiences over time. This theory came to be called the bundle theory of the self. And so he's not really saying that there is no self. He's saying that there is no deep-seated metaphysical sense of self other than this ongoing spectrum of experiences that we experience over the course of time being consciousness or being conscious. So this came to be called the bundle theory of the self. We're a bundle of sensations and experiences and perceptions, and that is what it means to be conscious. That is what it means to have a self, is to have I have my unique bundle of experiences, and you have your unique bundle of experiences. Right? Captain Picard's bundle of experiences is very different from Captain Sisko's bundle of experiences, but it just is those bundle of sensory perceptions and experiences that define who a person is, and there's no other sense of identity besides that.
Yeah, if I understand this correctly, there, you know, Hume's idea is that there is no distinguishing the many features of a person. So the same person is present and has been present, and again, there's no distinguishing. So, you know, we're a bundle or a collection of really, I think, different perceptions. I may be looking at this the wrong way, but I think about it like this shoebox that I have here in my closet that I use to keep old photographs in. The shoebox is always present, and while I add photos or remove photos from the shoebox, the shoebox itself can't be distinguished by the collection of articles inside. Am I seeing that the right way?
I think so. You know, as I think about this example, the bundle theory of the self as it applies to Star Trek, we already used the example of William and Thomas Riker. Right, that's an interesting case where William Riker beams down to a planet, and in the process of beaming back, a duplicate of him is created. And I think this occurred, you know, some years before Star Trek: The Next Generation takes place in the in-universe timeline. Right, some years previously, Thomas Riker got created in a transporter accident. And I think what's fun about the bundle theory of the self is it gives you a way out of this paradox, right? If when Thomas Riker was created, you can kind of ask the question, well, it sure looks like there's a duplicate of William Riker now, who has the very same experiences that Riker had, right? The moment that Thomas Riker is created, their bundle of experiences is literally exactly the same. As you know, time moves on in story, right? William Riker beams back to the ship and, you know, ends up becoming first officer of the Enterprise and has a bunch of unique experiences that are unique to him, right, as a character. And Thomas Riker, remaining behind on the planet, has a completely different batch of experiences from that point forward in time. But from the moment of their divergence, their bundle of experiences is no longer the same, right? I think you can ask this really interesting question. What about the very moment that Thomas Riker is created? You know, his bundle of experiences, according to David Hume's bundle theory, is literally the same as the William Riker who beamed back up to the ship. So does that mean there are two William Rikers? And in some sense, yes. And I think that's our intuition, right? In that very moment, the moment that Thomas Riker is created, it sure seems like that there is no distinguishing characteristic of Thomas Riker yet, other than the fact that he's in a different place in time, right? William Riker ends up back on the ship, and Thomas Riker ends up on the planet. So they're in different places, but their experiences at that very moment have not yet diverged. But the moment that they do, their bundles have diverged. You know, there's some overlap, right? The common experiences that they share growing up in Alaska. But from that point forward, their experiences have diverged. And I think this matches with our intuitions, right? If you don't have the same experiences as another person, if there's not a one-to-one overlap of experiences, then it sure seems like you're talking about two distinct people. Even in the case of William and Thomas Riker, and say, you know, 80 or 90% of their experiences overlap because of their common upbringing. But from that point forward, their experiences are diverging. And that seems to mesh with our intuitions that from that point forward, that William and Thomas Riker are literally different people, even despite the fact that they have the same neurochemistry and whatnot.
Yeah, this is a great example. And it's a really interesting puzzle because Will and Thomas are in every biological sense identical, right? I mean, if we want to go back to Leibniz's law, A and B are indiscernible. They both have the same chemical, biological, cellular. They're identical in every biological and physiological sense. The only differences are in their respective experiences from the point of the transporter accident. So we discover that those respective experiences have produced two significantly different people. I mean, let's break this down in the simplest sense. One of the interesting conversations I think they had was the fact that Thomas still kind of holds that grudge towards his dad, you know, and then Will says to him, you know, actually, you know, dad and I have kind of smoothed things out. You know, Thomas says, well, I don't care, you know, if I see him tomorrow, it'll be too soon, you know. So, you know, there's still... There are differences now because, again, once that transporter accident happened, they're two distinctly different people. You know, it appears that for the sake of the story, we've ignored the question, though, and I think we're going to dig into this a little bit when we talk a little bit more about transporter accidents. But, you know, I think we're forgetting something, and that's the soul. You know, are we just the sum of our biology? Are we the sum of our atoms, molecules, cells, and systems? Or is our identity defined and shaped by our experiences? Perhaps it's a combination of the two. And how does the question of the soul kind of come into this? Star Trek also uses kind of Data and the Doctor to explore identity too. And I think I'd love to do a character-driven philosophical show sometime in the future just to dig into that topic by itself and how it relates to these two characters. Maybe even our listeners would want to, you know, chime in and share their thoughts about it and how it relates to these characters. But, you know, I think when we talk about William and Thomas Riker, I think we have to raise the question of the soul.
You know, it's interesting you mention dualism and the talk of something like a non-physical soul, because that itself is another answer to the problem of personal identity, right? If our consciousness is literally something non-physical, in other words, if it's distinct from the gray matter that makes up our brain, right? If it's something, if it's soul stuff or some sort of non-physical you know, you could call it a soul, but call it a mind, right? The philosopher René Descartes, the philosopher that is called the founder of modern philosophy, he had a dualist view of the mind. He basically thought that people, you know, himself, as you know, writing his Meditations, he thought that consciousness was the defining characteristic of people. In fact, he has this term res cogitans in Latin. It means thinking thing. He thought we were fundamentally non-physical thinking things, as distinct from whatever our bodies and whatever the physical universe is made of. So that's one possible answer, right? It could be that our consciousness is something inherently non-physical. And if that's the case, it dismisses an entire class of physical changes, right? It doesn't matter what physical changes you undergo. Doesn't matter where, you know, what direction your neurochemistry takes. All of that is irrelevant if there's something non-physical that literally remains the same over time in the course of your life. But it's kind of a simplistic answer. It's an attractive answer because it dismisses, you know, the problem we mentioned of Sisko's goatee, right? Is Sisko the same person over time as he grows a goatee, right? Well, if Sisko is fundamentally something non-physical, maybe imprisoned or connected to his body in some way, you still have to explain how is this physical, non-physical consciousness connected to our physical bodies. And Descartes really gets in a lot of trouble when he tries to explain. In fact, he cited a gland in the brain called the pineal gland. He said, well, that's where the mind and soul, or the mind and body are connected to each other. And it's not a terribly satisfying answer, right? So, but it sort of pushes the problem back. If we're fundamentally non-physical consciousnesses, right, you can explain physical changes over time, but, you know, that doesn't explain how consciousness changes over time, right? You know, at the purely mental level, we do have different thoughts than you had previously in time. We can accumulate new memories, and it seems like our consciousness, our minds, undergo as much change as our bodies do. So I'm not convinced that the dualism answer really solves the problem of personal identity, although it does seem like it would be an attractive answer insofar as it just dismisses an entire class of physical changes that you have to take into account on an ordinary sense of personal identity. Like the ship of Theseus, we're talking about fundamentally physical things. The Enterprise being refit, we're not talking about something spooky and non-physical and mental. We're talking about physical change in the physical world. But if we're fundamentally something non-physical, you don't have to worry about some of those issues. So it does solve part of the problem. But my suspicion is that it just pushes the problem back and doesn't really address the fundamental problem of change over time, just given that the mental seems to change over time just as much as the physical does.
Yeah, definitely. Because, you know, we do very much observe, you know, both physical and mental changes over time. When we're talking about dualism, I think about Plato. He held to the idea that there were multiple souls. You know, Plato believed that we had a nutritive soul, that, you know, it was all about growth and metabolism. He believed that we had a perceptive soul that could experience things like pain and pleasure and desire. And then there was this other soul that was different, you know, that really kind of differentiated us from, you know, plants and animals. And that is, you know, the ability to reason. So then Aristotle mm-hmm. theorizes that, you know, all three of these souls perish when a living organism dies. But Plato taught that the soul didn't really depend on the physical body, and that the soul would migrate to a new physical body, you know. So that, you know, that again, that kind of brings us back to Janet Lester and Captain Kirk and the Enemy Within, with Turnabout Intruder. It makes me think about Captain Kirk, you know, when he had that transporter accident that separated the two halves of his hull, you know, and the Enemy Within. You know, he had a seemingly gentle side, but then he had a very aggressive side. It was darn transporter accidents, you know?
But do you think, Mike, that dualism really does solve the problem of identity? Going back to the example of William and Thomas Riker, if William Riker is essentially something non-physical, in other words, if he has a soul in some sense that is different from the stuff that makes up his body, when that transporter accident happens, how does a duplicate of him get created? How does Thomas Riker get created if you know, his body is duplicated? Absolutely. That's what the transporter accident is about, right? But how can a transporter accident duplicate a soul? So I think it's attractive in some ways, because it gives us a way of talking about an identity over time that persists despite physical changes. But in universe now, is dualism an answer to a case like William and Thomas Riker? And I think other accounts of the mind, like physicalism, in various varieties of physicalism, I'm thinking of things like emergent properties, the fact that consciousness could be an emergent mm-hmm. physical property that emerges out of these lower level activities that are happening in the brain. You know, as you put neurons together and they fire in certain ways, you get consciousness that emerges. So it's, I don't want to spend too much time talking about the nature of consciousness. That'll take one or more episodes of MetaTreks just to talk about that. But dualism, I think it probably, it's hard to see how dualism can even explain how that situation can occur in Star Trek. Even in universe, how can dualism account for the fact that a duplicate is created? Whereas, you know, the moment that Thomas Riker is created in the accident, there's an exact physical duplicate of him. So I like this because, you know, the criterion of Leibniz's law is met, right? There's a one-to-one duplication. Every neuron in Riker's brain has been duplicated in Thomas Riker.
Yeah, they're identical.
They're literally identical. And so at least it passes the criterion of Leibniz's law. And that seems like progress. And if you assume that consciousness is an emergent property arising out of whatever specific arrangement of gray matter, specific, you know, neural arrangements, or in the case of Data, it would be something like a neural net, right? You know, once those lower level properties are arranged in a certain way, you get an emergent consciousness out of that, Riker's consciousness, right? So now you've got a case where you have two exact duplicates. They have a one-to-one match. Consciousness emerges out of that in some way. So you can ask the question, where is Thomas Riker, or where is Riker's consciousness occurring, right? Is Riker literally conscious in both places? And I think at least that view can account for the duplication, our sense that there are actually two people there. It's not just like a zombie duplicate, right? Where Thomas Riker might be a physical duplicate but doesn't have any consciousness, right? If there's a one-to-one match, it sure seems like there would be an emergent consciousness that arises out of both of those physical beings. And that seems like what we see in the episode. So maybe the problem of personal identity, you know, is better addressed by this kind of physicalist view, at least in universe.
Yeah. And, you know, to answer your question in the simplest terms, Zachary, no, I don't think dualism answers the question because it fails to address the larger part of that question. I think probably it's a piece of the puzzle that I think deserves some attention, but I really don't believe that it completely answers the question. But it, and in some senses, it raises some questions that, you know, I think sometimes we don't ask. You know, when we talk about these transporter accidents, you know, I think we're almost kind of fulfilling a prophecy, if you will. You know, the season 4 episode of Enterprise Daedalus, Emery Erickson explains that when he first invented transporter technology, you know, to beam an object from point A to point B, that there was this debate about the metaphysical questions and that, you know, that using a transporter was going to raise. So I think to some degree we're fulfilling that even now as we're sitting here talking about these things. You know, Emery was literally the first human to go through, you know, the transporter, and he tells Trip.
Yeah, how would you like to be the first person to step into a transporter, right? You know, you're literally going to get taken apart and rearranged somewhere else, you know, however the transporter actually works, right? Is it energy, or is it sending matter? Or, you know, Star Trek isn't terribly consistent about how exactly the transporter works, right? But, you know, assuming that you get taken apart in some way, you know, your components get rearranged somewhere else, and you're an exact physical duplicate of who you were back on the ship, are you the same person in that situation, right? And I think the physicalist answer, if your consciousness is an emergent property, right? If, you know, if you're standing on the transporter pad and, you know, your consciousness is being generated by whatever's going on inside your mind, and in some sense determined, and this is related to the two-part discussion we had about free will and determinism in episodes 1 and 2 of MetaTreks, right? If your consciousness is itself being determined by whatever's going on in your brain, then if you take an exact duplicate of that brain, you rearrange it somewhere else, now down on the planet, that very same consciousness would be emerging out of the physical components of your brain. So I think on a physicalist account of consciousness, if your consciousness is some sort of physical emergent property, in other words, if we're not talking about spooky dualism, we're not talking about some sort of unpredictable, if your consciousness is fully determined by whatever physical processes are going on in your brain, then if you duplicate those somewhere else, it sure seems like the very same numerical numerically identical consciousness would be emerging somewhere else, because the only differences would be these inconsequential external relational properties, right? Yeah, you'd be in a different physical space, right? Your body, your brain and your body would be located somewhere else, but the internal structure of a brain would be duplicated in a not even in a transporter accident, in ordinary transporter beaming, an exact physical duplicate is created in a split second later in time, elsewhere in a different location, but the structure of what's going on in the brain would be duplicated, and you know the consciousness would be fully determined. But does that mean that there is an exact one? You know, is Leibniz's law met in that situation? Is there actually a one-to-one correspondence between the consciousness that was back on the ship and the consciousness that's down on the planet? Because it sure seems like there's a one-to-one relationship in the physical elements themselves.
Yeah, in universe for sure. You know, Emery told Tripp, you know, the first time he went through, he said he was terrified. Think about this for a second, Zachary. He said it took a minute and a half for it to completely cycle through. He said you can actually feel yourself being taken apart and put back together. It scared the crap out of me, you know. Later in the episode, we find out that Emery's son Quinn's been lost in a transporter accident. And so under false pretenses, Emery's trying to use a transporter on Enterprise to get him back. And so when this comes to light, you know, Danica is talking to Archer, Emery's daughter is talking to Archer, and she really raises some interesting questions about her brother in relation to this transporter accident. She says to him, "I wonder what it must be like for him. Is he in pain? Is he conscious? If he is, does he think that we've forgotten about him?" And I think those are some great philosophical questions right there in Daedalus that we need to ask ourselves when we're talking about transporter technology.
Well, this is directly related to the first part of our discussion on the continuity of consciousness. When you beam somewhere, if your consciousness is discontinuous, in other words, if you cease being consciousness and then, you know, a split second later, your consciousness reemerges and with all its same properties, all the same, you know, right, sort of like a moment in time, right? You hit the pause button and, you know, a few minutes later, you hit the play button again and your consciousness is exactly where it left off. But it's somewhat discontinuous in time. If that's the case, you have to ask the question, well, what does this mean for John Locke's view of continuity of consciousness? If consciousness is literally being interrupted, then that seems like a deeper problem about whether you're the same person. But if you remain conscious during beaming, if you can experience the passage of time such that even though at the end of the day, there's still kind of a one-to-one correspondence between pre-beaming and post-beaming, but I think that makes the case better for personal identity if you remain conscious through the process.
Yeah. And again, you know, I've got to, and as a theologian, I have to go back to, you know, this question of the human soul. What constitutes identity? Are we the sum? Are we just the sum of our parts? Or is our identity anchored into something much deeper? So that kind of takes me to Tuvix. Okay. Are we really dealing with a separate, unique individual with Tuvix? I mean, what happened to Neelix? What happened to Tuvok? Have they just become parts of this new object? Those darn transporter accidents.
Well, what do you think about that, Mike? I mean, so in the case of Tuvix, you know, is Tuvix? What happens to, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, what happens to Tuvok and what happens to Neelix, right? What happens to those individuals? In creating Tuvix, is Tuvix a combination of both consciousnesses that still exist, or is a third kind of consciousness being created because there's a different physical arrangement of components inside Tuvix's brain, right? If you kind of run with this line of reasoning that we started with, that consciousness could be an emergent property out of whatever's going on inside the brain. If you have a different arrangement because of its Tuvix's brain is a combination of the brains of Tuvok and Neelix, right? But it's different than either one of them. It has a different structure, a different arrangement, different neural patterns, however you want to characterize it. Would a different consciousness emerge out of that that is numerically distinct from the consciousness either of Tuvok or Neelix on their own?
You know, and that's what's so interesting about this particular episode.
I don't have an answer to that. I think that's the hard question, right?
I don't either. And I should probably say, Zachary, I don't have an answer to that. That debate probably is left to greater minds than mine, but I can't address the episode. I found it interesting that in the episode, when the transporter accident first happened, it almost seemed as though Neelix and Tuvok were very present in the person of Tuvix. And maybe it was literally written in. This is probably a question I'd love to go back and talk to the writers about. maybe it was written in, maybe it was a happy accident, I'm not sure, but it seems as we go along in that episode, interestingly enough, the characters of Tuvok and Neelix sort of fade away as this new character Tuvix emerges. I think it was necessary to really make what happened at the end of that episode, and I know we're delving into deliciously controversial stuff, but I think it had to happen in order for the climax of that episode where Janeway escorts him to the to sick bay and essentially takes the needle from the doctor and says, step aside, and essentially murders Tuvix.
For me, part of it may be the way the actor plays it, but I'm trying to replay the episode in my mind as you're describing it. And when the accident first occurs and Tuvix appears, is he surprised that he exists, or does he just sort of take it for granted that he exists and always existed? Is it like you get in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy when a sperm whale and a bowl of petunias all of a sudden, spontaneously get created, and all of a sudden they realize they're conscious, and 2 minutes later they get blinked out of existence, but there's kind of a surprise to it, right? Oh, here I am. I exist. Wow. I can't believe this. This is interesting. Or is Tuvix's existence almost taken for granted by himself? Does he just kind of pop into existence as a combination of Tuvok and Neelix, but without any real surprise to it?
Yeah, I think it had a lot to do with the acting, personally. Although I got to be honest with you, I think that would have just been a grand moment if, George Takei would have played Tuvix, and when the transporter accident happens, he's standing there in those colorful clothes and just says, oh my.
Oh my.
that would have just been wonderful. I think a lot of it had to do with acting. And again, I threw that out there knowing that there's no easy answer here. But I think it's an interesting question in the context of the conversation we're having.
Well, as I think about this more, I keep going back to this idea that consciousness could be an emergent property. So, if Tuvok's consciousness emerges out of his own brain and Neelix's consciousness emerges out of his own brain, then it sure seems like Tuvix's brain is numerically distinct from either one of them, right? If it's a combination of both, it's different from either one of them, right? Numerically, in the sense of one-to-one match between neurons, right? So in that sense, Tuvix's brain seems distinct, and it seems like his consciousness as an emergent property would have to be numerically distinct from either Tuvok's consciousness or Neelix's consciousness. So, that kind of makes sense, right? I mean, that's the way they play it in the episode, right? They treat Tuvix as a distinct person, and that's what raises all the ethical questions. Are you killing Tuvix in trying to save Tuvok and Neelix, right? This accounts for the moral tension in the episode. But as I think about this again, I sort of think, well, okay, what about the ordinary day-to-day progression of time, right? My brain now is numerically distinct from my brain 10 minutes ago or a year ago or 10 years ago, right? Different events have happened. There's new memories that have been formed. So even in my own brain, we're not talking about numerical one-to-one identity over time. Does this really solve the problem of personal identity or not? I think it handles it better than dualism, because you do get this one-to-one correspondence, especially when we're talking about transporter beaming, right? We talked about that already. So in the case of transporting, it sure seems like physicalism has an advantage over dualism, right? We can explain the creation of William and Thomas Riker. We can explain the creation of Tuvix and why we think that Tuvix is a unique person. But does it really solve the problem of personal identity, even in the ordinary sense? I'm not convinced, because as time moves on and new memories get formed, new neural patterns form, there doesn't seem like there's even one-to-one correspondence from one moment in time to the next. So I'm not sure this is a really satisfying answer to the problem of personal identity in general.
So, Zachary, what about alternate universes and mirror universes? Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, Mike, the last thing I wanted to talk about with personal identity is the sense of whether a person is the same in an alternate universe, or in Star Trek, you get the mirror universe or different possible worlds. And even in the ordinary sense, there's this sense of personal identity over in counterfactual situations, right? If I look back at my life, there's different choices I could have made and different paths I could be on. You know, if I had taken those other paths, that would still be me on those other paths, even though I didn't actually choose those paths and reality unfolded a certain way. But there is a question of personal identity in all of these cases, right? In an alternate universe, say in the Abrams verse in the new Star Trek 2009 movies and beyond, right? You can ask the question, is that Captain Kirk literally the same Captain Kirk as Kirk that we saw in the original series? We're talking about one-to-one numerical identity. Is it the same captain, the same individual, right? Even despite the fact that their realities unfolded in very different ways. And in the Mirror Universe, you have an interesting case there where, well, in the case of Captain Kirk, in the case of the alternate universe, right, their origin is the same, right? Captain Kirk is born, and then their experiences diverge from there. So we're talking about the same individual, but reality unfolding in a different way. But in a case like the Mirror Universe, you have two completely different individuals that have a lot in common, right? They look the same and sound the same, but the universes they're born in are different from each other. So you can also ask the question, are you the same person as your counterpart in the Mirror Universe? I think that's probably less likely, but it's an important question to ask. And in the case of counterfactuals, you know, what if reality in the Star Trek universe has unfolded a different way? You know, certainly there is a path that unfolds. As you look back at your memories or past events, you can say reality did unfold a certain way. But if it had unfolded a different way, would you be identical to your counterpart in that counterfactual situation in the very same universe? We're not talking about an alternate universe in that situation or a mirror universe. If the actual universe had unfolded in a slightly different way, would you be identical to your counterpart in the actual universe in a counterfactual situation? So there are these interesting questions of personal identity in these Star Trek examples, alternate universes and the mirror universe. But I think that's somewhat related to the question of personal identity in the actual world as it relates to counterfactual situations.
You keep mentioning Captain Kirk, but you know, when we're talking about mirror universes, I want to talk about Spock. I mean, the beauty of 1960s television, Zachary, is we know that these two Spocks aren't the same Spock, because Spock in the mirror universe is rocking the goatee.
It's interesting because, again, I kind of want to dismiss the mirror universe example, because that's a really plausible case where mirror universe Spock with a goatee is not, you know, there's a lot in common, right? But that Spock is not the same Spock as in the actual universe, right? Their causal histories are totally different. The continuity of their consciousnesses are totally different. Their bundle of experiences are totally different. So as I go down the list, checkpoint by checkpoint by checkpoint, there's no grounding for saying, for even thinking, even entertaining the idea that those two Spocks are the same individual, even though they both have the name Spock.
Yeah, I love the line, you know, McCoy says, "Jim, I think I liked him better with the beard. It gave him character." He said, "Of course, you know, almost any change would be a distinct improvement." You know, so I think the question here really is to beard or not to beard. That is the question, right?
To beard or not to beard.
To beard or not to beard.
I'm always pro beard personally. I like Spock in a beard. I think a lot of people would agree.
Yeah, I think you're right that we can almost dismiss the mirror universe, frankly.
There's a danger of Metatrex devolving into a Star Trek fashion show.
Yes. You
know, I like blue shirts.
We should do that.
I like Spock with a beard.
We should do that. Spock and Command Gold. Almost.
But what's lacking in the case of the mirror universe, though, is that there's no common origin point, right? Mirror universe Spock and ordinary Spock don't have a common origin.
Right.
Whereas in the case of mirror universe, alternate universe Kirk in the Abrams verse versus ordinary Kirk in the original series, there's a common origin point, and then realities diverge from there. So I think there's something to be said for having a common origin point when you're talking about personal identity. And even in the case of William and Thomas Riker, there's a common origin point, right? There was one person with a certain set of experiences in a certain mental state, then there's a divergence from there. But a common origin point seems to be really crucial to the idea of personal identity as we go through these examples. And so, you know, I'm thinking of different ways I can try to ground this philosophically. What does the history of philosophical discussion on personal identity and metaphysics bring to the discussion? But do you have any thoughts on that point about an origin point, Mike?
Well, that's just it. It's kind of difficult. And again, we can almost dismiss, you know, the mirror universe things. I do want to say, though, that it's kind of interesting, and it doesn't really talk to origin points. But, you know, for instance, in Shattered Mirror, DS9, you know, the mirror universe Miles is kind of inspired by, you know, the in-universe Miles O'Brien and what he was able to make of his life. So, it, you know, it had an impact on him. So that, in essence, changed him. I'm going to throw a little monkey wrench in here before we kind of close out our discussion. I want to just throw in DS9 Visionary, you know, Miles O'Brien and the kind of the temporal problem, you know, the Miles O'Brien that went ahead in time and warned himself about the Romulan attack. And so, you know, our in-universe Miles O'Brien dies there in the future and his past self comes back to in-universe and, you know, goes on living. They did this, essentially the same thing to Harry Kim in Voyager. You know, how does that kind of play into our conversation here in terms of the problem of identity?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it just kind of goes right back to the question of origin point, right? If the two Harry Kims have a common origin point, then, you know, you can make a case that they're identical in some sense. At least they have a common bundle of experiences, right? The two Harry Kims. In fact, in that case, their bundle of experiences is like 99.9% identical, right? There's only been a fairly recent divergence between the two ships, and there's fairly close to a one-to-one match in their bundle of experiences. So, but in a case of the Mirror Universe, it seems like you have two completely different bundles of experiences, two completely different origin points. I just see nothing to latch onto there. But it is related. You know, I think the fact that Mirror Universe Spock and Ordinary Spock are both called Spock is really important because... I'm trying to think of a connection here to the views of a philosopher named Saul Kripke, and he is mainly a philosopher of language, but he I think his views have a lot to are related to this in some way. He had this view that names are what he called rigid designators, that they designate the same individual across different possible worlds. And so I should back up just a little bit and say that a theory of possible worlds is one way of giving meaning to counterfactual type statements, right? What if John F. Kennedy hadn't been assassinated? That's a counterfactual situation. It runs counter to the way reality actually unfolded, right? What if Captain Picard was not assimilated by the Borg? That's a counterfactual situation. But, you know, we sort of ordinarily think of names as referring to something. When I say JFK, I mean the actual individual, John F. Kennedy. When I say Picard, I mean Captain Jean-Luc Picard. There's a referential component to the name. But what does the name refer to in a counterfactual situation, right? What if Captain Picard, who wasn't assimilated, that individual wouldn't have the same properties as the actual Captain Picard. So you need some sort of referential hook, you know, something for that word to point to. And one way of interpreting that is this view that the word actually refers to different possible worlds. It refers to a different alternate reality in which that chain of events did unfold, right? A possible world in which Captain Picard wasn't assimilated. And so basically Saul Kripke has this view that names refer rigidly to the same individual across different possible worlds. So when I say Picard, I mean Picard not just in this possible universe, but also in the possible universe where he wasn't assimilated, and also in a possible universe where a million other different possibilities could have unfolded. But that name refers to Picard rigidly, in other words, to the same individual across all those different possible universes. But the connection to naming here is really important because basically he thinks that there's naming is kind of a quasi-metaphysical process where, you know, think about what it's like to name a child, right? You sort of point to the child and you say, you know, I'm going to call, imagine Spock's parents, right? Sarek and Amanda standing over baby Spock saying, you know, baby half Vulcan individual, you shalt from here forth be called Spock. And there's kind of a baptism of a name, right? Where you point to the child and you say, you are Spock now. And from that point on, there's kind of a causal history, right? The parents continue to refer to the baby as Spock, and other people that interact with that person end up calling that person Spock. And there's a chain of events in terms of how that individual is referred to, a causal history of the use of the name. And Kripke kind of has this view that naming is this sort of metaphysical baptism, where across possible universes, that name refers to the same individual, regardless of how reality unfolds. So Mirror Universe Spock and the Spock in the Ordinary Universe have undergone something of the same baptism ritual, right? You know, they at least in both of those universes, the name Spock was handed to them presented the sort of naming process occurred. I don't, you know, who knows what that was really like. How do Vulcans name their children? I'm not sure we really ever find out the answer to that question. But at least Spock in both universes was given the name Spock. And so they have the same origin point in the baptism of their name. I think that's how Saul Kripke might give a reading of why we tend to think of those two characters as being attached to each other in some way, right? They're the mirrors of each other, not because of their common bundle of experiences, not because of the continuity of their consciousnesses, but there is an origin point for both of them insofar as they were both, there's a similar universe, right? There's something like a federation or the empire in the mirror universe, but there's a being that's physically similar to Spock and also has undergone the same naming ritual. And I think this is somewhat just related to Saul Kripke's views that there's a baptism of a name and that links different entities together across possible worlds. And it gives us a way of saying, you know, in these counterfactual situations, this name that we have refers to, you know, the same entity across different possible worlds, regardless of how similar or different those possible worlds become.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I don't think it makes for very interesting TV, but I think more likely what we probably should have seen in a mirror universe is a universe where Sarek and Amanda don't meet. There is no Spock. You know, he just kind of fell into, you know, the life of a politician on Vulcan, and he met a Vulcan woman, and... You know, you have this whole other line where Spock doesn't exist, but that's not very interesting television. So, yeah, I think this idea of names as a rigid designator, I think there's some validity to it, certainly.
Well, it's a fascinating idea because it does give you a way of deciding which statements are true or false, right? Because if you can take a statement like, in the universe where Picard wasn't assimilated, Picard would have done something different, right? Picard would have gone to war with the Romulans, right? Who knows, right? It doesn't matter what the statement is. But if there's a possible universe in which that unfolds and it's relevantly similar to this possible universe, you can point to that counterfactual statement. You can say that statement is true because there's a possible universe that it refers to. Whereas if without a theory like that, if you sort of say, imagine a universe in which John F. Kennedy wasn't assassinated, you can say, you know, John F. Kennedy would have done blah, 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 blah. And if that's not the actual universe, there's a danger that you can't even say that statement is true. So in the philosophy of language, you want to give some account of these counterfactual statements. And philosophers like David Lewis, who developed an account of possible worlds to explain counterfactuals, and Saul Kripke that's building on that in this view of rigid designators, right. and what came to be called the causal theory of reference, that you get baptized with a name and then there's a causal history of people learning to use that name. You know, a steady continuum of that name being used over the course of a person's lifetime to refer to that individual. That builds on this metaphysics of possible worlds. You know, again, what does this mean for personal identity? I think it's in the case of the mirror universe, it sort of just feels like it's not, you know, the question of personal identity just doesn't come up. It seems like in that case, you have two very different people that happen to have some properties in common. But in the case of alternate universes where there's a common origin point and a divergence, or in a counterfactual situation in our own world or in universe, these kinds of counterfactual statements, you know, what if the Federation had not been formed, right? That's a counterfactual in universe. And you want to be able to give some sort of semantic reading of those that you can say those statements are either true or false. Otherwise they're just meaningless mumbo jumbo. I mean, you ask the question, what if there were a possible world in which Spock hadn't been born? Well, in that case, certain statements wouldn't be false.
Right.
They wouldn't refer to anything, right? You know, what would Spock have done if Spock hadn't been born? Well, right, that's kind of a
silly
meaningless statement. It's a silly question. So I think that this metaphysics of possible worlds is an answer to those kinds of statements. They seem to, I don't want to say it solves the problem of personal identity, but it gives us a way to talk about an individual across possible worlds or in alternate universes and have those statements come out true or false, right? It gives us a truth functional you know, way of talking about statements, right? We don't want to think that our statements are just meaningless mumbo jumbo. We want to say they're true or false, even these counterfactual statements. And I think these theories do that. But the downside is that they're metaphysically heavy. And we talked about this a little bit last time, that if you don't need to posit a bunch of metaphysical entities to explain something, you don't want to do that. It's like Occam's razor in science, right? You want to prefer simpler mm-hmm. explanations. And if you don't need to posit possible worlds and rigid designators and causal theories of reference and metaphysical naming baptisms, you know, these kind of weird metaphysical ideas, if you don't need that to explain something, then you shouldn't postulate them. They're metaphysically heavy explanations. So I kind of worry about those explanations as just being metaphysically heavy, right? It's like positing dualism, right? If you don't need to posit the existence of a soul to explain some phenomenon, that is, you don't need to do it, right? You know, the preference for simpler, more ordinary explanations, I think, holds even into philosophy. So I worry a little bit about those kinds of explanations, but they're very interesting because they do give us a rich sort of philosophical vocabulary to draw upon. And it's, I mean, heck, this is Star Trek, right? It's fun to talk about alternate universes and mirror yeah. universes and possible worlds. And, you know, and then, you know, what's fun for me is that same kind of thing happens in philosophy. People geek out about rigid designators and possible worlds and causal theories of reference. And that's kind of the philosopher equivalent of geeking out about alternate universes or the mirror universe. And happily, they coincide, right? The discussion in one seems to inform the discussion on the other. So, but there is this danger that, you know, it's meaningless metaphysical mumbo jumbo at the end of the day, right? And I think that's the possible critique of all metaphysics, that it's just, you know, it's abstract and not terribly practical. And I think the whole problem of personal identity is like that, right? If you're intrigued by this notion, you know, like me earlier, I mentioned the example of reading my own diary, right? When I read my own diary, the question of personal identity comes up for me. I notice that I'm not the same person as I used to be in some regards, and that I seem to be the same in other regards. But if that's a terribly, you know, interesting, problematic question, then, you know, these metaphysically heavy philosophical theories might seem really important and interesting, right? If they help you ground your sense of identity and in universe, if you can, you know, make better sense of why the mirror universe Spock and ordinary Spock seem to be connected in some deep way, you know, they're fascinating. But, you know, it's just,
yeah,
like all philosophical questions, they're somewhat abstract. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of practical import to these theories of possible worlds. And I do care a lot about the ordinary sense of personal identity too, and I'm not sure how helpful they really are for that ordinary sense.
Yeah. I feel similarly when, you know, I'm going through my shoebox of photographs and I, you know, I pull out one of, you know, me at, say 17 with, you know, with a mullet. Am I that same guy? You know, God, I hope not. But, you know, you were talking about the Vulcan naming ceremony, and my attention deficit mind started going to, you know, to Pal, thou art Spock, and what thou hast witnessed forever shall be, and it carries over to universes. I don't know. But and we've been going on, you know, for well over an hour here talking about the problem of identity. And, you know, we certainly could have gotten into yesterday's Enterprise and talked about Tasha Yar and Sela, and there's so many different places that we could have gone, and I'm sure we'll go in the future. And as I predicted, you know, almost too much here to cover in an episode. But, you know, just for my final thoughts, you know, I was correct that we were going to dig deep, and we did, and didn't even begin to peel back the layers of the discussion. You know, what am I? Who am I? Am I a creation of genius? Am I a collection of molecules and cells? Am I the sum of my parts? Am I the sum of my experiences? Or am I a combination of all these things kind of rolled up into one? You know, am I that shoebox of photographs, and you add and you take away, you know, perhaps maybe even more something more. So, you know, it's funny because my mind goes to a Measure of a Man from the Next Generation, you know, the JAG captain. You know, she said, you know, is Data a machine? Yes. Is he the property of Starfleet? No. You know, they're kind of wrestling with his identity. They're almost trying to answer the question for him, you know. And so, you know, Picard says, you know, we've been dancing around the basic issue. Does Data have a soul? Is that really what this exploration of identity is all about? You know, are we just a sum of our parts, or are we something more? And it's a fascinating conversation. It's a fascinating question. It's one that there are no easy answers, not in the real world and not in the Star Trek universe. Those are my final thoughts.
You know, when I think of philosophy in Star Trek, I think this is the issue that probably comes up right off the bat for me. And I think for a great many people and philosophers who use Star Trek as examples when they teach philosophy, I think this is the low-hanging fruit when you're talking about philosophy in Star Trek, right? Star Trek has transporters in it, and transporters raise the issue of personal identity. And so this is just the obvious philosophical issue when you're talking about Star Trek. That said, I think it's also one of the hardest to solve. I think our intuitions get pulled in radically different ways. You know, we when we see movie Picard and we see TV Picard, or we see Cisco season 1 or Cisco season 7, I think we're pulled in a couple of ways, right? We see some deep-seated character traits and values that are the same across those characters, and we also see a lot of differences. We see the phenomenal changes in their appearances and their demeanor. We see their personality evolve over time. And so our intuitions get pulled both directions, and of course, like all philosophical issues, when you have competing intuitions, that means there's some, you should try to give some answer to that. You know, which is the right way to think about it? Which intuition is more correct? And personal identity is hard in that regard. I think it's one of the harder issues to solve. And I love talking about personal identity in Star Trek, because I think, you know, like I said, philosophers can geek out about crazy metaphysical ideas that we talked about, and like possible worlds and naming baptisms, the thing we mentioned. But there is this sense of personal identity in the ordinary sense, right? I think philosophical issues are in danger of being so abstract that they're not important. And personal identity is one of the most important philosophical issues we can ask, because mm-hmm. it deals with the question of who we are as people, right? I want to know that I'm the same person, that the things I do now will matter to me 10 years down the road, right? I throw myself into the future and I look back and I reflect on the meaningfulness of the past to me. And that's deeply tied with my sense of my own, not numerical identity, but my own sense of self-identity, right? Who I am as a person is tied up with me being the same over time. And if that goes away, I think we're in danger of losing something about ourselves. So I do care a lot about preserving the sense of personal identity. And, did we solve the question? Probably not. I think, you know, we're going to say this again and again and again on Metatrex, that there's a danger that we're not going to solve any of the questions, right? These are going to remain open philosophical questions. But I hope that looking at the question of personal identity through the lens of Star Trek examples has helped. And again, I always hope that the philosophical terminology helps make sense of some intuitions that you have about Star Trek examples, right? When we talk about John Locke and the continuity of consciousness, you know, I hope that listeners to our show, you know, go back and look through examples of the Star Trek universe where that comes up. You can go, oh yeah, this is a new way to think about it, right? We can talk about whether the evolution of Captain Picard's consciousness and personality is continuous or discontinuous when he's assimilated. What about Seven of Nine, right? You know, we're all Star Trek fans. We love to geek out about those examples. Are theories like David Hume's bundle theory of the self, does that give you a new terminology that helps make sense of your intuitions about these examples that you know and love from talking about Star Trek? And so I think here, this is a happy marriage where, you know, the philosophical discussion that goes on about personal identity is really directly related to our intuitions that we have about different examples that you see of personal identity in the Star Trek universe. And there's a lot of overlap and a lot of discussion. The discussions in philosophy and the discussions in Star Trek fandom really overlap a lot. And there's a lot of parody to those examples. So I hope making the connections has been really helpful and interesting to the listeners today. And, again, I'm sure we'll revisit this. I feel like I could give an entire seminar, you know, 15 weeks worth of discussion just about the problem of personal identity. I know we're going to revisit this again and go into some things in more detail, but I'm glad we got to hit a lot of the highlights.
Absolutely.
You know, some of the theories we mentioned are the main theories about personal identity. There are others. We can go into some things in more depth, but these are the big ones. So I'm glad we got a chance to tackle this so early in our run here on Metatrex.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about the problem of personal identity in Star Trek today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
A. Mugatu. B. Gorn. C. Tribble. Or D, Horda.
Isn't Mugatu from, like, Zoolander?
Here's the thing, right? Okay.
Earl Grey.
Oh, by the way, 6 hours in, if you press shift, you'll run throughout the whole game!
Press shift when your characters are moving, and they'll actually move at a reasonable pace.
Reasonable!
The Orb.
if he had like a game card, his power, you know, like would be higher than any other captain for their persuasion power.
You'll be like, damn, I was winning. And then he went and played a Cisco card on me.
The ready room.
Here's one more thing I want to throw out here for you guys. Recasting this episode, because I know you guys like to do this on To the Journey with things, with series and such. I think that Ma'ab should be played by Will Ferrell. To the Journey!
There is that moment where badass Janeway plunges down with a phaser rifle in hand and takes command of the situation. And so there is that redeeming moment.
That is an awesome moment, but it always pissed me off because I'm like, why would you send the captain down first?
Right?
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Lost World's a terrible movie. I haven't seen Jurassic World, though.
The 602 Club.
We wake up in the middle of the night and I pop back in episode 5 and I watch it again. Like, there's something about this movie that from even then, you know, I'd seen them all, it's all clean slate. This one was already my favorite.
Literary Treks.
It definitely starts in a very dark place and it doesn't get much brighter at all, you know, until we get to the end and you know, there's some hope there. But yeah, definitely it's a dark book.
Women at Warp.
And then Tom's basically like, well, after we like infiltrate the fortress, we'll free Chaotica's harem. And no, like, we,
it's gonna turn out they're already being freed by Furiosa, and it's gonna turn into a whole nother holodeck program.
Meta Treks.
I want Lieutenant Commander Einstein sitting at my conference table my briefing.
Would that be
a
blue shirt?
He would totally be a blue shirt.
Just making sure.
And you know, even though the bushy mustache is technically not Starfleet regulation, I'd let him keep it.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website, and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. We invite you to contact us. You can contact us by going to our website, trekfm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on the MetaTreks show page on Trek FM's website or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our username is @trekfm.
And you can find Trek FM on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And if you'd like to talk philosophy with us on Trek FM's listener group, the Babel Conference, just go to the Facebook search bar and type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, and the listener group, the Babel Conference, will come right up. Or you can go to our website at Trek FM and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a star rating and review of MetaTreks on iTunes. That really helps others find us when they're searching iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show.
Well, Mike, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference. I'm also on Twitter. My username is @cmichael1701. Zachary, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me in Trek FM's listener group, the Babel Conference, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. You can also find me on Twitter, and my handle there is just Zachary Fruhling. That's my name. ZACHARYFRUHLING is how you spell that. We also want to take a few moments to acknowledge our team here at Trek FM. We'd like to acknowledge C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek FM. Our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau. Aaron Harvey, Trek FM's art director. Will Wynn, Trek FM's content manager. Richard Marquez, our production manager. And Dennis Costello, our editor and producer. Well, everyone, thank you for listening to this episode of MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.